Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Welcome to Screen Talk, IndieWire's weekly podcast, coming to you from the mountains of Telluride, where this is Eric Cohn, chief critic and deputy editor, sitting on a bench with Ann Thompson as we gasp for air, trying to adjust to altitude.
Looking
and
at the gorgeous mountains.
Yeah, exactly. And also taking in the scenery before we sit in a bunch of dark rooms for 4 days.
Before it starts to rain.
Yeah, exactly.
Because the forecast is rainy. And I'm not wearing my hat because it may be wet.
So she's harder to spot. But yeah, there's a lot that's unpredictable about Telluride, but also a lot of stuff that we know going into it. This year in particular, because one of the biggest, most anticipated movies we were fortunate enough to see ahead of the festival, Roma, which already screened in Venice. And we agree that it's amazing
masterwork.
Movie. Yeah.
It's a masterwork. It's beautiful, stunning, black and white, and it's not your conventional narrative. It's basically a series of anecdotes, but things do happen, and it's almost an upstairs-downstairs kind of look at a 70s household in Roma neighborhood of Mexico City, very much detailed and based on the youth of Alfonso Cuarón, the filmmaker, who has spared no detail in bringing this incredibly moving, incredibly beautiful kind of neorealist work.
Well, but what's really cool about it, too, is that even though it's based on his childhood, and there is a younger child in the film who sort of is the basis for him.
Yeah.
It really
is.
It's
not the youngest one, though. It's the 10-year-old.
The 10-year-old, second youngest. But they're not the main characters. The main character is this housemaid and sort of how she's kind of a silent witness to all the stuff that's happening around her and sort of absorbing all the tensions of this family while dealing with a lot of her own hardship and searching for ways to kind of, you know, verbalize that. I found that to be really striking because the film sort of reorients your perspective. It's not a coming-of-age story about the kids. It's more like this woman having to be the supportive kind of force in their world while also trying to keep her life together, and the way that it kind of gradually explores her experiences in this really interesting moment in Mexican society, it creeps up on you. It casts a really unique spell. It's an interesting movie to hype because it's not about what happens in the movie so much as what it's like to experience the movie.
Well, that brings up the issue of this extraordinary 65mm Ari Alexa crisp black and white image, and of course he's taking, because for various reasons his cinematographer of choice, Chivo Lebeski, was not available, the one who's won 3 Oscars in a row and helped Iñárritu with his VR and all that. So the person who ended up doing the cinematography, of course, was Cuarón. And so you look at, this is one of those like Sherlock Jr. credit things where you see written by, directed
right.
by, produced
Although
by,
Although to his credit,
shot
he's
by,
kind of,
edited
he
by.
Puts, he puts a lot of that stuff in the credits on screen alongside other people's names, so it doesn't feel totally self-serving.
I'm not making fun of him. It's just that it is what it is.
I mean, it's
a personal
yeah,
work.
He's writing his memories with the camera, essentially.
So he's going from gravity, right, to this. And by the way, it can't be ignored that there's the Three Amigos aspect of it, where these extraordinary Mexican filmmakers are basically dominating the landscape, with Guillermo del Toro winning Best Picture last year with Shape of Water,
yeah.
with Iñárritu having already gone in there with Birdman and all his and Revenant. You know, he's in there too with Babel, all his
right.
films, and now we have this extraordinary movie. But this is a Spanish language movie. It will be eligible for the foreign language Oscar,
and which should be a slam dunk in any
contest.
In any
case, they've got to submit this.
And it has quietly opened in Mexico, so it will qualify in that sense. But it is an interesting play because when you think about it, so the whole Netflix of it all, having seen the movie now, one of the things that I thought was kind of fascinating about it was that this is a movie that could be very rewarding if you've seen it before to come back to the study details and so on and so on.
I can't wait to see it again.
Well, that's the thing. So Netflix subscribers, if they see the movie and really love it, will have that opportunity. And I guess the real question is that going to work in its favor that this movie is actually very available?
It'll be a repeat viewing experience.
Right, but it's also a 2.5 hour movie that you kind of have to be open to. You kind of have to live with
it.
I'm
glad I saw it in a screen.
Yeah, you should see it in the theater. You absolutely should.
I don't think people should be interrupted or looking at their phones.
So it is a real test. It is a real test of what Netflix can do with a movie like this. Can it actually create this international phenomenon while at the same time giving it a theatrical life, letting it be celebrated that way? And I feel like maybe this weekend in Telluride we'll get a sense of, you know, how does it play in this context before it goes on.
We're the target audience, but we're a small audience, you know.
Right. How will non-movie people
react?
Is
it an art house? It's obviously going to be a huge art house hit, but you know, how big will it be? It could play for Spanish language audiences all over the world, but still on the art house end of the spectrum, I would suggest.
So the other movie that's here that's coming from Venice with some hype around it is The Favorite, which I actually had the opportunity to see early because I'm moderating a Q&A with director Yorgos Lanthimos, and that one I'm even more curious about, to be honest with you, because I think Roma will play well at any festival, and they can screen this in
a
lot of places.
It at all four.
Yeah, in addition to, you have to assume lots of small regional places, and it's gonna have that kind of life. The Favorite is a really cool, funky movie in a way. I mean, it's got bite to it, and
I shot it with candles.
It's got a Barry Lyndon-esque vibe. I've been thinking more of like Marie Antoinette in a certain way, because there is a more of an ironic element to the tone of the film, but it's just a lot of fun. So I think it'll play well, but it's a very nasty film. It's Yorgos Lanthimos. There's bite to
it.
He didn't write it, but I guarantee when you see the film,
it's his.
You will see scenes that there's more of like, there's a physicality to it that's kind of wacky. So I'm really curious about how that plays here.
I'm looking forward, needless to say.
And then we have all this stuff that we haven't seen. Old Man and the Gun. Is Robert Redford going to be a slam dunk best actor candidate? That kind of stuff.
That's a question mark.
So in the next few days, a lot of stuff can happen.
Searchlight has three movies. The other one is Old Man and the Gun, David Lowery. I hear, by the way, that Stacey Spacek is very good in that.
Well, it's been a while since we've been able to say that.
So that's, you know, that it may be more her movie in a way.
It'd be great.
They're selling Redford right now, but, you know, you never know.
It's misdirection. And then they catch you off guard.
And by the way, it's a total clusterfuck tonight, Friday. Every movie's playing opposite. You know, you've got First Man and Front Runner back to back. In one theater, opposite White Boy Rick, which, by the way, screened for the Volunteers last night, and it played well.
Always
so I'm really looking forward. And on the plane were Jeff Robinoff, first time Telluride, along with very old school Telluride attendee John Lesher. Mm-hmm. They're the guys who made White Boy Rick over at Sony, mm-hmm, with Jan Demange, who did 71. So I'm excited. Matthew McConaughey will be here as well. And Hugh Jackman is coming for the first time with The Front Runner, which is another Sony movie with Jason Reitman, who's an old hand.
Yeah, so there's a bunch of stuff like that. But honestly, when people keep asking me what am I excited to see, because I've seen some of the higher profile stuff.
I want to see the SAS.
Yeah, well, that one is certainly one worth talking about. I want to see Destroyer, because Karen Kusama, since Girl Fight, has always been an interesting filmmaker, even when she fails. Like, Aeon Flux, actually an interesting movie that doesn't quite work. Actually, if you go back, it's an interesting movie that doesn't quite work. But she's in this really fascinating phase after An Invitation where it's like, it seems like she's sort of rediscovering her roots. And this detective movie with Nicole Kidman, I don't know if it's going to be for everyone, but it does sound like it's got a late night screening slot, which I remember was what Under the Skin had here. And I'm just really excited for something like that. It's got the Telluride context, but it's not quite on people's radar the way some of these bigger films are. Look, I need to be surprised by stuff. I'm really curious about Sebastian Silva making making his Telluride debut with this film called Fistful of Dirt, which was shot in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. So there is stuff kind of lurking in this lineup.
And then we both had the chance to see Thank You Netflix again. I had this great day where I was over at Netflix seeing movies back to back in screening room, you know, moving around but they have multiple screening rooms.
Living on beanbags.
They have this enormous cafeteria that takes up like a whole floor, and they've got more snacks. And apparently the people who work there talk about the Netflix 15.
They don't want you to leave.
Because they came late. Exactly. And on my way out at like 9:30 at night, having seen three movies, there was, including Roma, by the way, there was Adam Del Dio, you know, from the documentary side, working, you know, at 9:30 at night, coming into the building.
Snacking away.
I can testify to his 24/7.
But the snacks took you off course, because what you were going to say is we saw the other side of the wind.
That's what I was going to say.
Orson Welles' restoration, which I think a lot of people were just sort of assuming was going to be this huge mess of a thing, it's actually quite fascinating. And as a huge diehard Orson Welles fan, don't forget, I named my cat after the guy. F for Fake is one of my favorite movies. I found it very satisfying to see that there was enough here to really appreciate some kind of vision that he was trying to pull together. It's not a finished movie per se, but seeing John Huston playing this Wellesian character, it's great. And the rapport
and
that he has with
Huston did his voice, and where there were holes.
Yeah,
I did not know that,
you never would have guessed the way they stitched it together, and the chemistry between John Huston and Peter Bogdanovich
is
like a buddy movie or something. It's really funny.
So I was having a conversation with Morgan Neville, who directed the documentary that goes with it, which I haven't seen, but I was asking him, because there's black and white and there's color, and the if it were me and I were not executing purely Orson Welles's vision, I would have made it all black and white. Not the movie within the movie, that's in color. That silly movie with his mistress wandering around naked.
Right, which is actually called The Other Side of the Wind in the film.
There's a party where you can spot all these people that I've known for years,
right.
You know, I'm wandering around, like Henry Jaglom and the great, late, great Paul Mazursky.
Even Les Moonves was at that party.
Apparently, I looked at the credits, I know. Todd McCarthy was at that party. And a key role is played by this critic I've known for years, named Joe McBride.
That's right, Joseph McBride, great scholar and critic. So it is a really cool kind of snapshot of history.
But the black and white is better than the color.
Yeah, I mean, the way it oscillates between these things, I don't know all the
technical details.
Yeah, why that happened.
We're going to do a story on that.
It is very interesting, because it does feel a little bit like this was the only way this movie could possibly exist. It's a movie about an unfinished movie, but but it is really interesting, because on some level it feels like this movie was designed not to be finished, because the plot of the movie is that they couldn't finish the movie, and it's about Welles in a way.
Relationship with Peter Bogdanovich.
And being bankrupt.
Who's playing himself.
And, yeah, I mean, it's just
it's very sad, actually.
Yes.
It's very touching.
Yes.
And it's also, there's some dialogue between the two of them that actually I found moving. There's a moment where Peter Bogdanovich, realizing that his incredible idol, this man that he's revered for years, who he can't seem to come through for enough, is basically killing it, you know, killing their relationship. And he looks at him and said, he quotes, they talk about Shakespeare a lot, and he quotes, and our revels ended, you know, the Shakespeare, our revels are ended. And it felt really sad.
Yeah, no, it is a sad. And if you see the Morgan Neville documentary, They'll Love Me When I'm Dead, it really helps contextualize a lot of what was going on there, because that relationship does fall apart in real life between those guys.
But after this movie.
After this movie.
That's what's so
interesting. You are watching something real happen in a way. And I also think that the scenes of Oya Kodar, Welles' partner, in this movie within a movie, wandering around basically naked the entire time in a very bizarre, abstract thing.
It looks a little bit like Zabriskie Point or something.
It's like Welles is saying, like, oh yeah, the quote-unquote art films that you people think are so great, like, I can do one of those in my sleep.
It looks great, you know, but it's so sexist also.
Yeah.
It really is.
Although,
she's the utter object of sexualization.
It is worth pointing out that there is a critic character in the film who is basically saying that throughout the movie. The power goes out halfway through, and there is a conversation about the sexism in the film. So even there is a degree of self-awareness. I guess, again, going back to the Netflix question, it's going to be a real test. Is Netflix a good platform for a film like this? Yes, it will be available all over the world, but will people say, watch the documentary and then get really into watching the movie? Will they want to watch the movie? Will they turn it off after 5 minutes? It really feels like this platform has been inching towards a moment like this where actually compelling, challenging films that wouldn't even be here without somebody like this with the kind of deep pockets to make them happen are putting something out there.
Or the technology existing today.
So it really is going to be interesting to see how do they launch here, and then how does that launch lead into the lives
that they
have.
But we'll never really know, because they're never going to tell us.
We got to keep pressuring them.
You know, they're going to keep churning out this stuff. And it's a fascinating moment, you know, longer conversation, but where Netflix and Amazon, which also has a film here, Peterloo, the new Mike Lee, which I'm excited to see, which didn't go to Cannes, but is here, and these Netflix movies didn't go to Cannes, but they're here.
But then you have something we haven't seen at the time of this recording, First Man, which feels like the more traditional kind of Oscar movie.
Got great reviews out of Venice, as did Roma.
So it'll be interesting.
As did The Favorite.
But the thing is, Roma, to me, doesn't feel like a traditional Oscar movie. I mean, it's only traditional.
It's a foreign language.
The foreign language Oscar movie.
But they're going to push it.
Right. So that versus this, you know, Ryan Gosling, Damien Chazelle, Neil Armstrong movie.
Right.
It's going to be really interesting to see, you know, where the chips fall in that respect, and the fact that they're all at Telluride. I mean, we should talk about this
also
for a little
bit.
Also
the debate about The Favorite. I think we should talk about these more after I've seen them.
Well, I guess in a broader context, right? Why does Telluride matter when a lot of these movies, all three of the movies we're talking about, already premiered in Venice?
Okay.
What are they going
to
get?
So Venice I've been to, and Venice is a great festival, and obviously these movies have all debuted there. Roma, First Man, and The Favorite, and there's more to come. But they don't have the media, the American media, the Oscar pundits, the critics, the people who create the buzz, and also the buzz that's created at this actual festival.
Right.
That's what's one of the wonderful things about this festival. You wander around from day to day, from theater to theater, standing in line or whatever, and you find out how these movies play.
Yeah, you wind up trapped in a gondola after dark, and you can't see the person, but you know it's like non-industry. Like yesterday, I was checking into my hotel, and some total non-industry person from the Pacific Northwest was talking about how he loves Yorgos Lanthimos. He called him a horror Wes Anderson type of filmmaker. And it's like kind of interesting because you do kind of get outside of that industry bubble of critics and distributors
there
and all that.
There are art houses all over the country, and there are people who watch Netflix all over the country. That is the reality.
Yeah, and it helps to be in an environment like this where you can kind of see that before diving back into it in Toronto, which is kind of like business as usual, as much as I do appreciate that
so
festival.
So the third Fox Searchlight movie is Can You Ever Forgive Me, which is Mariel Heller, based on a screenplay by Nicole Holofcener, starring Melissa McCarthy. That's a question mark, you know, how that's going to play here. Is that a Melissa McCarthy performance? And then on The Favorite, how does it go? Does it go Olivia Colman supporting with Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz in the lead?
Right.
How do they decide?
Everybody's
that?
Saying Colman for lead.
Nordine was saying supporting, right?
Yeah, Michael Nordine was saying. To me, it's like the problem with that is that Rachel Weisz is the really strong supporting performance in this movie. But
who's the lead? Is it Emma Stone?
It's kind of divided between the three of them, so it is really tricky to make that call. I mean,
that's why they're waiting for us to tell them.
But that is the essence of the movie. You know, it's essentially a love triangle about people competing for attention. So, you know, talk about meta storytelling in that sense. But it'll be really fascinating because by Monday, we will have, I think, a much different perspective on how these movies are doing. I mean, remember last year, Downsizing opened Venice and played pretty well, and then it came here and it just tanked. So, you know, there really is a difference in these environments that can shift the narratives
very
around
true.
The movie very quickly. All right, so we should get on the bus because we're going to go travel up the mountain for a little picnic.
Get
and
rained
then
on.
Go see, get rained on, gas for air a little bit more, and then go see Old Man and the Gun. So let's keep the weekend going.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.